Join us for the Criterion Institute podcast as Joy Anderson, a global thought leader in business and social change, leads us through a series of discussions, interviews, frameworks, rants, and reframes that will help you better understand how to use finance as a tool for transformative systems change.
I am Joy Anderson, and this is the Criterion Institute podcast. The first segment in today's podcast is a conversation with Sarah Wolf that I had when she was driving through Connecticut and stopped by for an afternoon with her amazing daughter. And we got to spend time just talking, and I thought, heck, let's just record some of this. And so you'll hear a few of those conversations coming out. In this segment, we talk about the kitchen table. I think often about how we resource and manage processes of innovation and insight. How do we bring about imagination? And I think about the effort we've put into the last 10 or 20 years, ensuring, securing, guaranteeing that we can manufacture innovation. So what if being at the kitchen table is what all that's meant to be? I have some of my fondest memories as a kid doing homework at the dining room table, at the kitchen table. I remember my father set up most of his work at the kitchen table or some table in the family space. And so that people were coming and going while you were working. Because maybe it's the kitchen table where it's all at and not some fancy office building with shiny whiteboards. My conversation with Sarah explores the concept of the kitchen table as a space for creativity, collaboration, and transformative change. Sarah is a remarkable leader. We have been friends for many years. She is a midwife working in impact investing. And her ability to tie those things together and ground it in tradition is remarkable. So this conversation highlights the importance of relationships, informal processes, and listening. And it emphasizes the need to redefine success and challenge traditional norms. In a second segment, a new section I've dubbed practices, one of the practices we use at Criterion, which is about carrying around ideas. Maybe if the conversation with Sarah is about the kitchen table, this is about the back pocket or the bottom of your pocketbook. The importance of testing ideas in conversations, being open to feedback and learning. Enjoy. So what if being at the kitchen table is actually what's meant to be? I have some of my fondest memories growing up doing homework at a kitchen table, sitting with my family talking at a kitchen table. Maybe kitchen tables are where it's at, eh, Sarah?
I mean, absolutely. It's where things are at. It's, you know, like they say, it's 1,000 cups of tea to really get something important done. To build a good relationship, you have to take that time. But kitchen tables is where everything happens. You know, we have dinners with our family. We, you know, get our children. We keep track of what our children are doing in terms of their homework or their activities. It's, you know,
where we build businesses.
Where we build businesses. Where we do the mending. It's, you know, the clean laundry gets folded on. Everything happens at the kitchen table. So why wouldn't the most creative?
You built your business on a kitchen table.
I did. So I was a baby midwife at the time and, you know, was being told, start your own midwifery practice. There were no Indigenous midwives in Toronto at the time except me practicing. And the community was asking for an Indigenous-focused midwifery practice. So I was like, okay, I'll try and figure out how to do this. You know, why not? I've been practicing midwifery for a year. I know everything, of course. And so I found a couple of student midwives who were Indigenous and We, you know, got together at my kitchen table and we had pot after pot of tea and built the strategy and built the proposal and, you know, visioned and dreamed everything from what we were going to call it, which ultimately became Seventh Generation Midwives Toronto, to how we were going to operate and how we were going to distinguish ourselves. And it was great. We built this whole midwifery practice at the kitchen table. And then we all agreed that the practice would be based in my house. And so we ran the midwifery practice on the ground floor in the basement of my house. And I lived upstairs and had my babies upstairs. And as the practice grew, because we went from, you know, just me and a couple of student midwives and one other practicing midwife to support us, we grew to 4 midwives and 6 midwives and then 8 midwives. And then when we were up to 10 midwives, by that point, there was no room in the practice anymore for big meetings. So we used to meet once a week to do case reviews. And so everyone would come up to my apartment and we would all sit around my kitchen table. And we started to see there was a need for a space for people to have birth in the community because they didn't feel safe in the hospitals. They didn't have homes to have their babies in. And so we said, well, we'll build a birth center. Let's start planning and visioning and strategizing around how we're going to do that. Well, where are we going to do that? Around the kitchen table. And we continued to do it that way.
You know, so then you built this building.
We did.
And then you finally got away from the kitchen table, right?
Yeah, right. So I built this amazing, amazing birth center in Toronto, in the inner city. And it was 12,500 square feet of just a remarkable, remarkable space, except there wasn't an office for myself. I totally, in all of the planning that we did not put an office for me to work in. And so I would literally go in and say, is there somewhere I can sit and squat today to do my work in the building? And more often than not, it was in the kitchen at the counter or at the kitchen table in the birth center. And so I continued to work around the kitchen table. And then there was this other thing that happened where I decided to leave midwifery and clinical practice, which was a big decision in and of itself, and then to transition to impact investing and social finance. And finally, for the first time in my life, had my own office, my own desk, my own chair, my own space that I could go into every day, work, and then leave at the end of the day. And 6 months in, we got a global pandemic and I got stuck working at my kitchen table.
which just, again, there's so much judgment and norms about what work is supposed to look like and what valid work looks like and what successful work looks like. I remember a story of a woman who was working on maternal health, a device. She had come up with some way cool device that was revolutionary, and she was on the news and like had big backers. And so they sent her to this accelerator to grow this beautiful business that she ran from her kitchen table.
Yeah.
And the hotshot MBA guy from some business school kept saying, to grow a bit, you know, to be a business, you have to want to grow. And she didn't want to grow. She actually wanted to stay at her kitchen table. And then I walked in and she somehow thought, oh, she's going to be more helpful, because I was talking about nonprofits and how you build a nonprofit. And but one of the points that I was making was that starting a 501c3 in the United States can be really difficult. And so don't start one, because you can't shut it down. Like, you don't own it, so you can't just walk away from it. And I was probably making a kind of esoteric note, but this woman walked up to me sobbing at the end of the day. And I'll never forget. She just felt like she had been on this journey that got her to this place, largely with other people telling her what success looked like. And she just looked at me and she said, well, I don't want to grow and I don't want to leave my kitchen table. And so is there no structure that I can actually live in?
Wow. So fascinating, right? And it speaks to this whole idea of like, what is impact investing if we're not asking the question, what does success look like to you? Because that's really the impact we should be making, is the, you know, what does success look like to the person who's running it and the community that's being served by it?
Thank you. I think pretty often about how we resource, manage the processes of innovation. And I think we've put a lot of effort over the last 10, 20 years into ensuring, securing, guaranteeing that we can manufacture innovation. And so design shops, folks who focus on the design and development of new ideas, have turned these into processes and practices. And some of those actually are great, right? They've created more inclusive, the sort of thinking about who you invite to a session where you're going to design something, how to make sure there's stakeholders in that room. Some of these processes have gotten to more inclusion. Some of them have made it too expensive to do inclusion. And so one of the practices at Criterion is to lighten this process, to think about it as carrying around a set of insights in your pocket and testing them informally, rather than an intentional process of saying, I'm going to figure this thing out, and then doing everything I can to figure it out. Criterion has the remarkable gift of being able to say, what can we figure out? What are we figuring out? What just got figured out? And what do we do with it so that we can be responsive to insights? And so part of this just requires that as we move to the next level, so we come up with an idea, we think about a way that you can use finance to, you think about a way to use finance to create change. And so, for example, I've been thinking about this idea of how trade finance could connect to sexual exploitation in supply chains. Been wandering around with that idea for a long time. How can we actually value the risks of sexual exploitation in specific supply chains? I've maybe written it down in a short white paper, but we've never actually had a whole design session to figure it out. But each time I take it out of my pocket, metaphorically, and I go, I wonder what people say in response to this idea. And then I bring it out in another room and I'm like, I wonder how people respond to it in this idea. And then somebody will say, ooh, that actually is connected to a thing we're trying to do in this agricultural supply chain. And so the currency of these insights becomes important. And what's interesting in that is informal processes, if they are intentional, can be more inclusive. You can be in a conversation with somebody who is working on issues of sexual exploitation, who's working on the ground, and you can throw this idea into a conversation more efficiently for us and for that grassroots leader that we're talking to, than inviting them to come to a day-long meeting in Nairobi where we're going to figure all this out and they have to give us a day at a time. And so part of the stewarding of our resources and of the resources of particularly leaders who are strapped for time and who experience time poverty, to shift those power dynamics and have them be included, requires that we think about efficiencies in informality rather than building structures that ensure inclusion. And it's a balancing act here. There's many times where the kind of structure of inclusion is needed, but it's often needed because people don't have relationships. They don't know who to talk to. So our priority is always going to be to actually build the relationship, to be in relationship, to be in conversation, not to have a formalized process that makes us look like we are. So how do you start, right? What does it take to do this, and how do you get started? So part of it is having a set of ideas, wandering around with a set of ideas. Second is it requires that you're listening, not selling. That you're listening to people's feedback. You're hearing if they question the ideas. And not at that moment saying, ooh, they question the idea. I'm going to take this all down and never think about it again. But when people question ideas, hear it. Take it on. Think about why they're questioning. Learn from that. Incorporate it. Change. So how to start? Think about a couple concrete ideas. Because these also have to be tangible, right? They can't be, how do we create world peace? So maybe think about a couple concrete ideas that you want to carry around in your pocket that are, what change would this create in this context? And incorporate them into conversations. Maybe just have one idea for a while that you test. And you test in as many conversations as you possibly can. Because what that does is it lets you step into the conversation with innovative ideas. It lets you step in with a thought, with a solution, with a possibility, not something proven, not your answer that's all figured out, but what is possible. Give it a try.
To learn more about our work, visit us at criterioninstitute.org. And if you're enjoying this podcast, please leave us a review on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. Your reviews help our podcast reach a wider audience. Thanks for listening.